From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, we are on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And on today's show, we're going to be bringing on an experienced and highly successful entrepreneur, Todd Michaud. He is the CEO of Hooloop. He's had a lot of experience in the corporate world. He's also built startups before and had some great success. So we're going to be hearing his story today and finding out what Hooloop is. It's one of the growth factory companies that we're so proud to be a part of and changing the world right here in this hometown that we love. So stick around, but I want to warn you that at the end of the show, I am going to talk a little bit about how I arrived at my mission statement. And that mission statement, I think, as you know, it took me to launching the show and took me to the launch of the Growth Factory and Haney Biz and all the different things that we do today. But there was a period of time when I did not know what I was going to do. I was actually lost. And with the help of these two Japanese words, I kind of stumbled my way into doing what I'm doing now. So stick around. And at the end of the show, you'll get to hear a little bit of that story. But now get ready for Todd Michaud, CEO of Hooloop.
Entrepreneurs are the heroes of the American economy. They take the risks, create the opportunities, and move the molecules. Now, back to the Marquee Media Studio, it's the Mark Haney Show.
And now it is my pleasure to introduce you to Todd Michaud. He is the CEO of Hooloop. Todd Michaud, the Frenchman. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm Frenchman. Yes. Hi, Mark.
Where's the accent? You lost the accent.
I lost the accent, right.
That's awesome. Well, I look forward to telling your story, the story of Hulu, but you've had all this success, so I want to make sure we talk about winning and maybe some of the principles associated with people that are successful. You've obviously, you know, we were just talking, you've been married about as long as I have. I'm coming up on 38 years. You guys are still together. Your kids still live around here. You're doing some things right. And maybe we can swap stories a little bit on the principles of winning, because winning in business is vitally important, but winning as a family, I would say, is probably more important. Would you agree?
That's definitely most important. Exactly.
Okay. Well, let's get a little bit about your background and then tell us about Hooloop.
Sure. I've lived in this area for, I guess, the better part of 20 years. Both my wife and I grew up in San Jose, and I've had a long-term career in technology. I've started with Big Blue, another IBM guy that I know you had one of my good friends that I used to work with on not too long ago with Mark Hockridge.
Yeah, we were talking about the benefits of working in a corporation, a large corporation, before you go out and go on your own.
Oh, man, I learned so much from IBM. I learned how to sell. I learned how to talk to customers and take good care of customers. I actually thought that I was going to spend my whole career there. But I got the opportunity to lead a company back in 2000. A couple of my business partners during my time at IBM merged together and formed a new company. And that was actually my first startup business. And it was all about building a great company, scaling it, and then ultimately selling it so they could retire. And we had a great ride, built a great company. And
was that Revionics?
No, it was a company called IDS.
IDS, okay.
We sold it to a public company called Retalix. 5 years later, about a quarter late, according to them, they wanted it to be built and sold in 5 years, and 5 years and a quarter is what it took us. But we had a great, great ride building IDS up, and then it's still today is existing, and it's part of Retalix, and which ultimately got sold to NCR.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, so you started your startup experience quite a while ago.
Yeah,
so that was one big win. Prior to Hooloop, what was your big win in business? Was that it, or was there another big win?
Yeah, so IDS and Retalix were big wins for me personally, for our team. For our customers. And so some of the funnest time of my career. I also had the privilege of leading a company locally here called Revionics, which was a really successful company in the retail pricing analytics space. And I didn't stay on, to see that company sell, but it finally sold a couple of years ago. And I was very proud to lead it earlier in my career, but got to take it from a relatively, small company, no people, no money, no product, to a point where, it started to get some traction. And now today it's the undisputed leader in the retail pricing space, which is really the first generation of artificial intelligence. And so over the last 15 years, I've done a lot of work with data science, analytics-based companies, artificial intelligence companies. This all led, as the precursor to Hulu. I know that that's ultimately what you were asking me about. Last summer, I had the opportunity to launch Hulup with some friends that I've worked with over the years at a local company called Agria. They had been building a really terrific product for 5 or 6 years, and they're a large professional services company, and they were investing heavily in the software product that was the precursor to Hulup. But if you're a services business, you're a services business. So last year we started talking about carving it out, creating an independent software company. And we did so last summer, and gosh, it's been going great ever since. We've had some really fun times.
So talk to me about that process of spinning that out of an ongoing corporation. Yeah. Pros and cons of doing a business that way.
Well, what was great was they Agria had invested heavily in the product. They had a solid foundation, good team. And so as we carved it out, we, of course, got the benefits of their investment. The team came over largely into the new company. And so I would say that it's really a terrific way to form a new company. If you're looking to de-risk a situation, we had a product that had been in market with customers, scaled at high volumes. And really what it needed was a software mentality, a focus on driving it as the main thing rather than
something. The side project.
Right,
so
exactly.
It's interesting to think about this entrepreneurial effort, and then eventually you go, it's really not part of the core mission as much as maybe we thought it was going to be, I assume. Because I assume it wasn't built to spin off. It was built to because it felt like it was going to be a part of the core business.
Right.
And then it turned out that it needed to be on its own to fly.
That is so true. I think that they built it out as a benefit to their core business, which was providing professional services. And so it was an artifact as a part of their long-term services engagements. But what they found was that they were not benefiting from a market that's become big, it's growing very rapidly, and it's a software business. And so ultimately, by carving it out, it was able to flourish as a software business. Now, still today, Agria happens to be a terrific partner to us, and they're still using our product as a part of their professional services engagements with customers. But we're able to focus on innovation. We're able to focus on adopting new customers outside of the Agria base of customers. And it's just been a fun ride. Agria has been a terrific partner. They're still actively involved with us and will continue to be. But Hulup has been doing really well. Just to talk about winning, back to your main theme. Since the summer, we've taken on about 18 clients. We're happy with that. I guess I should say I'm never happy with that. You always want to see more, but customer adoption's been great. The types of customers that we're working with are the types of engagements that we can grow with over the long term.
And are they enterprise or mid-market?
Yeah.
Okay,
there's some
customers.
Of both. Generally, we have both types of customers. We have the capacity to work with relatively small companies all the way up to some of the largest companies that we all know and love.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe I want to dive into this, but maybe for our audience, could you describe the product to us? Because I want to make sure that people understand what we're talking about, an enterprise solution and what that means. What is that product?
Sure.
What can it mean? I mean, it can mean different things.
So let me start with what's the problem we solve for enterprises, because I think the reason why we exist is that most enterprises today have their people doing what I would call tedious, mundane BS work that we don't want our people doing. Now, why is that? It's because they have legacy processes that have kind of grown up around their technology over the years. And so our company exists to go into those enterprises and provide automation to augment the human team. So leaving the technology that they have in place, we essentially provide an array of AI-powered digital agents that are role specific. And essentially, if I'm a purchasing person, I can have a purchasing digital assistant help me do my work. If I'm in the pricing department, I can have a digital assistant helping me do pricing. The goal is to kind of take the tedious, mundane work off the plates of our people so they can focus on things that add more value. And so we essentially will automate, the stuff that can be automated, and then we unlock a lot more human capital or capacity, to focus on things that matter. Now, when
can I ask? Sure. Jump into that. So, if I'm in pricing or purchasing or something like that, I will have it'll be like a personal assistant. So the existing technology stays in place.
Exactly.
It's just you take the grunt work out.
Exactly.
Okay.
So someone needs to do data maintenance or maybe some transaction processing, or maybe there's some documents that need to be wrangled. Those are great use cases for automation. And so part of what makes, Hulup unique is that we really focus on harmonizing the activities that humans do and the activities that we can automate, the activities that we can apply artificial intelligence to. And so we call our company Hulup, Human in the Loop Intelligent Automation, because we're very much a people-centric
human
business.
Human in the Loop. I was human wondering how the name came up that way. So Human Loop.
Yep. Yeah, Human in the Loop.
And
so what does that mean? That means that, we've all seen the movies. We've seen Terminator with Skynet, with robots taking over the world. We're not that. We're essentially a technology company that serves people. And the way that you get people to embrace technology like ours is you recognize that humans are better than artificial intelligence at certain things. Humans have emotional IQ. They can make those judgment calls around maybe people issues or HR issues. Nothing is more frustrating than having a customer service experience with, a chatbot. So humans are really good at, those sensitive customer service situations. Now, having said that, you can augment people. You can essentially do some of the things that, happen behind the scenes and then put people forward in places where people should be injected. Now, what we found is that part of our strategy for, hopefully winning the market is, we're essentially going to help humans be less fearful about the risk of losing their jobs associated with technology. This is really mm-hmm. about job transformation rather than job elimination. Giving people the right to decide, how do they apply automation? When do they use it? When do they inject themselves? And I always tell people a story. I just drove past coming to your studio, the Tesla. And of course, Tesla is well known for self-driving cars, right? And maybe on Interstate 80 or Interstate 5, you're okay to, use the auto driving capabilities of the Tesla. But if you're on windy Highway 49, you probably want to have your hands on the steering wheel, at least on the curves. And so Human in the Loop basically is a similar mentality in terms of how we enable automation. Let's let humans have their hands on the steering wheel when that makes sense to do.
Well, AI is in the news now every day. You can't turn on CNBC, which I got behind me. You can't turn it on without hearing about AI and the different things that it's doing. And it is put out there in a way that almost, it's probably the news, but you know, people are, have a paranoia about AI, and part of it is losing their jobs, I suppose. But part of it, I think, is, you know, computers taking over the world and that kind of, right? The, you know, the science fiction type stuff. What's your, where do you come down on that? How do you put people at ease associated with, I mean, not necessarily your product, but AI in general?
Well, I do think people are fearful, and but, you know, if you look at the reality, people are working harder than ever. They're time starved. We're stretching our day. We're working from home in many cases. And so the way I look at it is, if I could improve your job, if I could improve your quality of life, if I could have you home for dinner, if you're using your head more, you feel more engaged in your job because you're not doing, mundane data entry. Isn't that a good thing?
It is to me. I mean, right. I would not, luckily I do not have one of those type of jobs, but people do. And it's, you know, we need those people, right?
Right.
But well, at least we used to.
Well, you know, one thing I tell people sometimes is, when I try to demystify Hulu specifically, I say, look, we're all afraid of ghosts, right? You're afraid of ghosts. We're sort of the Casper, the friendly ghost of automation. And so, when we think about, our bots, our automations, our digital personas, they're really friendly AI designed to make people's lives better and to help the companies that we serve have better performance. And at the end of the day, that's winning for them. If I can improve their productivity, 20 to 30% with the staff that they have, that's a powerful thing. If I can collapse the cycle time of business processes by 40 to 60%, that's a pretty powerful thing. If I can improve employee satisfaction because they're happier with their jobs and they're willing to stay at the company longer, that's a powerful thing. And so at the end of the day, once people understand how we can help transform their work, I think that the fear subsides and we become that Casper, the friendly ghost of AI.
Well, I have to imagine, because you're dealing a lot with bigger companies, that you can go out and do a sort of a test case, let's say in pricing, and the pricing people are happy with it. Now you take it to the rest of the company. It's almost like, hey, just let us in the door and try it in one department.
That's actually the greatest opportunity for Hulup to grow and scale we can start small, and our ability to move quick is really quite differentiating versus maybe some of the adversaries. So we can land in an enterprise, have them up and live with 5 to 10 automations in less than 90 days. And usually it's as much as 90 days because the company has work to do. And then beyond that, you're exactly right. It can expand into other departments as people say, hey, do you think that might be available for the marketing function or for the accounting function or for HR? And so our long-term strategy is let's give people a test drive, a taste test, and then have quick success with them, be able to quantify the value that we're delivering, and then try to grow within the enterprises.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about selling to enterprise-type customers and mid-market-type customers. You have partners like Agria,
yeah.
And are you selling to Agria and then they redistribute it? Okay, that's how it
so,
works.
So, well, we have direct sales as well.
Okay.
So probably the majority of our deals now are sold directly by Hulup and our sales team. As a software company, we'll quickly stand up the client and then we'll help them with the professional services that they need to go live and get value out of the product. Then we have a number of partners like Agria, and Agria is a fantastic one. They serve some really terrific enterprises all across North America, and they've done a good job getting us exposed to a number of their customers. We're essentially expanding our partner network. And so we probably have about 10 partners that we're actively recruiting, probably, three that we'll try to go live with here in this second quarter. And that'll expand our channel coverage.
So what's the benefit of going through a partner versus selling direct? How do you measure that in terms of like deciding what your channel partner strategy ought to be?
Yeah. So, it's all around the customer's aspirations. And so oftentimes, clients have the desire to do digital transformation or augmentation of their team. And so a professional services organization like Agria, can essentially bring, the talent and resource to the table surrounding our product, just to help the customer move faster, help the customer with maybe skills that they don't have. And so our philosophy on partners is, what we do, can be quite involved and strategically important to the enterprise. And they may need the guidance of a consulting and systems integration organization. And so let's give them that option through our partner network. And then when they kind of have the mentality that they're going to implement our technology themselves, deploy it and roll it out themselves, which some companies have, then they'll be able to engage directly with Hulup as well. And part of what we're doing with our technology is we have an AI powered no code system, and just to kind of describe that. So imagine you're an enterprise and you want to do some form of digital transformation in your supply chain or whatever it happens to be, but you want your own people to lead that. The way that we build our technology is, in the past, we would have done everything possible to empower the IT folks with that client, the programmers, the database analyst, et cetera. What we do with our platform is we're really building it for non-technical business people. So imagine that I am the supply chain business leader, and my process owners or business people are now empowered to essentially use our capabilities to build the automations that are uniquely relevant for their business without necessarily having a dependency on IT. And so that's kind of a difference in terms of how technology is being deployed today.
It's easier to deploy than maybe it was in the past, because you don't need to bring in the IT department necessarily, or the software development team to connect it all up. Okay.
Now, by the way, the litmus test for being able to do that, it's got to be so ridiculously easy to use, intuitive. And so, as we build out our capabilities, I always put pressure on my product team. You ask the question, well, Mark, what do you have? Do you have an Android or do you have an iPhone? And let's say that you say, well, Todd, I have an iPhone. And I say, well, how many apps do you have on your iPhone? And you'll say, I have 100 apps. And I say, well, Mark, how many of those did you go to training on? Well, I didn't go to training on any of them. I just, they're so easy. That's a simple, beautiful app-like experience. And that's what we're trying to do with Hulup. Now, if you can do that and make it easy to learn, easy to use, fast to deploy, and all of a sudden, you're sort of liberating, the business. And almost every business today, business function, let's say department function within an enterprise, has got a bunch of things that they want to do. But it's kind of queued up in that IT backlog. Sorry, I can't get to it. I've got project A or project B that I need to do. And so with respect to intelligent automation, our business, it's so impactful. We can't afford to wait. We can't afford to wait for the IT backlog to clear, because it'll never clear. And so how do you, empower, your business people to essentially, work with a platform like Hulup, automate the things that are relevant for their business, engage with IT, for governance or what have you. But essentially, the people that are driving the platform are really the owners of the process.
Who's typically the decision maker in the, when you go out to make a sale?
Well, so I'm going to kind of give you a more complex answer. So normally, the people that own transformation within most enterprises are either the chief financial officer or the chief technology officer. And again, the larger the company, the more that's the truth. But the people that we really help are the people that might be leading sales, leading marketing, leading supply chain. And so they're ultimately our key stakeholders that are benefiting from the technology. And so the CFO, might have kind of a, cost, reduction lens, as they look at automation. The chief technology officer may be looking at the application of technology. But look, if you're, the chief revenue officer, you're looking at how do I drive top line. If you're, supply chain officer, you're looking for, identification of inventory across the supply chain and the efficient movement.
You know, that's interesting that you go into so many departments like that, because your sales force has to be able to put on that hat, right? Whether it's cost reduction or, revenue growth, which lens they're looking at, so that you can be talking about ROI and that kind of thing, right? Because it is sort of a financial.
It is.
I mean, even though it helps morale, it kind of is a. To HR, right?
People buy our solution because they want to save money. Of course, we'll have the secondary benefits that we'll share, but they're mostly looking. How do I drive productivity? And in this market, they've got two primary challenges. One, they can't get the talent that they need, because of the scarcity of talent, low unemployment. Or two, maybe they're an organization that's doing some belt tightening. And if you're doing some belt tightening, the work never goes away. And so you have to have a strategy for how you're going to accomplish the work with a team that's not growing or frozen, or in some cases, these organizations are reducing talent. And so, that's the main benefit that we deliver, the compression of cycle time. You can usually quantify benefits there. And then, we also think really about what can we do to influence the top line and the bottom line. And so if we're helping someone with more effective pricing, more effective promotions, other types of customer engagement activities, we can sometimes have an impact on their growth strategy or their overall profitability as well.
Yeah. So how fast, I can imagine people asking questions like, how fast is it going to pay for itself?
Yeah. So depending upon what they scope out. So you're right. We can go in a lot of different places. And that's one of the difficulties that we always have is that we've got this amazing arsenal of capabilities. And how do you explain it, to different potential stakeholders? Generally speaking, the first point is, can we deploy it quickly and can we deliver quick time to value? And the answer is, when we sort of compare ourselves against our main adversaries, we will deploy in a fraction of the time. So, when you start, getting the ROI is faster than maybe some of the adversaries. But generally, what I often tell people, and what we will normally do a return on investment assessment for our clients as they're working with us, is that it's pretty rare that I can't prove to them that I can produce $20 of financial return for every dollar that they pay me. And so it's a 20-to-1. And so look, it's a simple analogy. It's a $1 bill for a $20 bill.
Okay, so interesting, because I'm picturing some of our audience members maybe being like outside sales reps, mm-hmm. or maybe they own a company that is looking to be good at enterprise sales. Walk me through that 20-to-1 thing, just so that I can understand when do they get to $20, right? So you don't get it on the first day.
So let's think of it within the scope of an annual software subscription. And so, we need to be making a pretty big impact on that $20 versus $1 cost within the first year. And so deploying quickly and helping the client, immediately get either the productivity savings or the compression of cycle time, et cetera. We're doing that, within that 90-day window, we're starting to deliver on that benefit. And because our cost, is allocated over a time horizon, the benefit is also allocated over a time horizon as well. And so, it's almost, you could practically say by the second, quarter after signing, the system is paying for itself.
Okay, I'm going to go back again. Thinking of our audience, right? And it's interesting to me, but it might not be interesting to the consumer. But how to choose these channel partners really is interesting to me versus sell direct. And do you? Is there some choosing that channel partner? The right channel partner has got to be critically important, because there's standing up your solution, and it's got to work, and it's got to make you look good. And so, choosing these partners that are trying to get your product out there as well, versus maybe, signing somebody up to be a partner that's not driving new business for you. Why do that?
Right.
So what goes into that piece, and are there exclusivities? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's two main things that we look at when we're signing up a partner. One is that they have, the partner has expertise either with automation or transformation activities. So let's imagine that it could be a consulting or services company that does that. Or two, maybe they have some domain expertise in a particular sector. Retail industry is something that we focus on as an example. And so someone is super deep in the processes of retail. And so we sign them up to be a partner because they speak the language of retail and they understand places where our solution can be applied. And so that's some of the criteria. And then we're also thinking through, well, what is this partner going to be able to do for us? Are they go-to-market partner, meaning that they've got the ability to market and sell, or are they ultimately an implementation partner? Are they all of the above? Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to make sure that we understand what their role is. Now, once we've selected a partner, we're really conscientious about not having a channel conflict or overlap. And so if a partner is working with us on specific engagements for clients, we work exclusively with them, on that engagement. And so we always we think of our partners as stakeholders as well. We want them to make a lot of money. We want them to be wildly successful. And so we're not wanting them to have, margin erosion because they're fighting over the professional services of our deal.
And I think that for people that are maybe interested in this space, but maybe not involved in it yet, this channel conflict and getting this right is vitally important because you can piss a lot of people off.
That's right.
You can hurt your business by having to redo your strategy over and over and over again because of one particular person or a couple of people getting upset by the way the business is handled. So it's important to do it right.
So far we haven't made any mistakes with our partnering. I'm sure we will, but so far, because of our youthfulness, we've had some amazing partners. They were carefully selected, well trained, and they seem to be doing a really good job taking care of our shared clients. And we got to have that same intense quality control to make sure that when they're out representing our capabilities, that they're representing our capabilities in the fashion that we want to be represented. We want them to be a positive reflection on us, and we want, at the end of the day, there's a simple metric. We want 100% delighted customers, 100% referenceability. That's the goal. We want customers to continue to renew our subscription product because they feel like we're delivering a strong ROI and they're happy with the outcome, and we're a pleasure to do business with. Whether that's through a partner or directly, that's what consumes us. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. Okay, so I'm going to tweak the conversation a little bit. So uncertainty in the economy, we all know that there's recession fears, there's inflation, there's higher interest rates, mm-hmm. there's people that might be pulling back in certain industries. Correct. What's the state of enterprise now in terms of enterprise spend?
So most enterprises are pulling back on their spend. Particularly with big projects that have long-term ROIs. And so base hits versus home runs are what many are focused on. Now, I guess I'll relate that to our business. And in some strange way, I think that the economic headwinds that we're facing make the challenging an economy an ideal time to rethink how you do things, and maybe to think about your staffing plan, augmenting it with the digital workforce as we talked about, to maybe minimize your investment in labor or what have you. So I guess what I would say is while it's definitely a tough time to be generally a technology company, I think it's actually an ideal time for Hulu to be able to go in and make a significant impact for these businesses that are trying to traverse pretty uncertain times. And so everybody that we talk to is dealing with one or another economic fear, economic issue, access to capital, access to talent, too many competing priorities that they need to be able to fund and resource. And we can be a problem solver for the companies that we work with. And if we're not, then we don't deserve, their business in the first place, right?
Yeah, you bet. One of our mutual friends, Five Star Bank, we were talking about John Gregory, or I was thinking about John Gregory, but all the people who are Five Star Bank are good people, and I know you have a relationship with them as well. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, actually, they're a fantastic bank. I should probably say this in light of the stress that we've all gone through with Silicon Valley Bank over the past few weeks. Whether you're talking to investors or you're talking to tech companies like ours, it really sent fear through the market. I got to tell you, I felt very relieved that I was dealing with Five Star as opposed to
me too.
And there's things that I think Five Star brings to the table. One, they're actively involved with the local tech community. I love that about them. You talked about John and other people. They're so supportive of a business like Hooloops and, helping us. I should, go on record. One of the things when I first signed up with Five Star, I said, John, you've got to give us an opportunity. When we first deposited our big check, you got to give us an opportunity. He introduced me to your CIO, and he was kind enough to do so. And I talked the CIO into doing a proof of concept with us. And we had a great POC, and Five Star is now not only my bank, but it's my customer. And so I'm happy to say that, I love those guys, and, they're truly terrific. Any entrepreneur thinking about, where they're going to deposit, maybe they're raising money and they need support, Five Star Bank is really a terrific option here in the local economy.
I would agree with that 100%. They've been my bank for the last several years, and the people are just different there. And I think our money's safe with Five Star. I think people have this, this fear because of what happened with Silicon Valley Bank, but it's a Five Star strong.
And I saw again just a couple of weeks ago. You may have seen the same article. I this kind of caught me by surprise, but they were ranked a number one, in an S&P, ranking for being, the safest bank at their asset size. And I saw that. I thought, well, right here in Sacramento, that was kind of encouraging. Yeah. And so Five Star's been very supportive. Also, the organization that you lead, Growth Factory, has been a phenomenal partner to Hooloop. We want to be a local company with local support, we love working with local business people, whether it's our bank, our counsel, our accountant, our investors, to the extent that local investors are involved. We talked about our partnership with Agria. We are through and through a local Sacramento company trying to take advantage of all of the rich talent and resources here, in the region. And Growth Factory, I'll just call it out, give you an unsolicited plug. I found it to be really a terrific organization for supporting someone like me, who wants to be on top of how to raise money, how to attract talent, what sort of advisors should I be surrounding my company with. Please know that you also have a really terrific team, and I really enjoy working with them. It's something that this market really needs, and so I'm happy to be a portco of Growth Factory.
Well, we're proud to be part of it as well, part of Hooloop. So Sacramento region has done well. Well, you've raised your family here. One of the things that's interesting to me, and we talked about this, so as we sort of wind down the show, I think getting to know what makes a successful life is important. So you and I have both been married, close to 38 years. We've got adult children. Our adult children didn't leave. They stayed close by, so they must not hate us too much. And so to me, that's success, right?
Success,
that's what makes me, when I get up in the morning, I think about my family, my friends, my community, the great country that we live in. Those are the kinds of things that give me peace. And to me, that's winning. And so I feel like I have that. When I meet you and you said you'd been married around the same amount of time and your kids live close, I'm like, what do you find is like the key to have building that?
Well, you know, a couple of things. First, we're lucky because it's not just my kids. And, you know, now we're up to 8 grandkids. And so having the opportunity to see them every single week, to go to their basketball games, baseball games, et cetera. Yeah, that's a blessing. That's actually a lot of fun. And, we celebrate the holidays together. There's never, the concern that there's an airplane in between us. And so we're so fortunate that our kids have grown up. They went to college locally. They married local people. They're raising their families locally. And that means that, we can see them as frequently, as we want. Maybe it's too easy to see us now. I don't know. But, that's definitely a blessing. And I think that in many parts of certainly California, guys like us will, see our kids grow up and then they sort of scatter, to the winds to different parts of the country. I love the fact that they're, building, their families here locally. And, I'm going to probably die here in this region. Not soon, I hope.
Yes.
But, I'm happy to be here.
Well, yeah. And, I think all great change in America begins at the dinner table. And if we can have a close family and a strong knit family that have the right kind of values, that's the backbone of America. And I think it is part of that's entrepreneurship. And for me, I feel like my wife has been the backbone of that unity in many ways, because I'm a little bit more of the driver and we have an agreement that I make all the big decisions. She makes all the little decisions. So far, though, 38 years later, there's been no big decisions. So I don't know what happened. But it is, that's the kind of, I have 8 grandkids too. So I look forward to hearing more and getting some more wisdom from you on how to build a successful life.
You kind of look back and you say, how did this happen? How did I have so many people? But, it's great. It's good to know we have so much in common.
That's cool. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Now, let's get Mark's perspective and closing thoughts from today's show. We're back to the Marquee Media Studio. It's the Mark Haney Show.
Welcome back to the Mark Haney Show. And as promised, great show today. Todd Michaud of Hooloop delivered, shared some words of wisdom, and really, I think, inspired a lot of us because he's doing something great, building something new, building something cutting edge. And that's really what this is all about. When we started the show, it was all about sharing stories of winning, sharing stories that would make people listening think, hey, that's interesting. I didn't know that that was happening right here in Sacramento. And if it's happening here in Sacramento, well, maybe I should be thinking about my creativity and my imagination and what I might want to do with all that. And maybe there's a way for me to change the world. But that didn't just happen overnight, right? This journey that we're on right now has taken thousands of nights. They say an overnight success actually takes thousands of nights. And I think that's true. And we've had some success, but I would not call us an overnight success. And I think we are a work in progress. But as promised as well, I told you that I was going to tell you what led me to this journey in the first place, how I got to be in a position to start a show, and why I'm so passionate about igniting the entrepreneurial revolution. And really, this journey and where it began, it began because I didn't want to be working for a larger corporation. I thought it sounded appealing to me, but as our business got a little bit more corporate, we had sold it, and I was sticking around for a while, and it just wasn't for me, so I quit. And for the first time in my life, I was unemployed. I was, really lost. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had been focused on selling security cameras for so long. Oh, wow. Now I have to figure out something else. And one of the things I did was I bought a dry erase board. And that was really the beginning of dreaming up where we are today. I I decided I wanted to write a mission statement. And some of you have heard me talk about my mission statement, you know, with future generations in mind, I will help create opportunity for my family, friends, and community. And as they succeed, I succeed. And that mission statement, how did I get to the mission statement? So if you don't have a mission statement, you should probably have one. How did I get to the mission statement? I used a Japanese word. I had heard of this before. Some of you may have heard what a ikigai is. It's kind of like your calling, right? So what you were meant to do in life. And since I was unemployed and I didn't know what I was going to do, I'm like, well, maybe I should try to utilize this tool, this Japanese tool, to figure that out. It's really the intersection between these four things. What do I love? What am I passionate about? What am I good at? What skills and strengths do I have? What the world needs? What problem might I solve? And what I could get paid for? And that led to the idea of creating opportunity. I loved it when I've been in a position to help people to find new experiences in their life, maybe buy a house, or even a few of our employees did really, really well with our business. And those opportunities that we created, that was rewarding for me. So that's what led. So then what do you do with that? Creating opportunities is kind of that North Star. So I began investing. I joined the entrepreneurs organization to be around other entrepreneurs. And then I discovered there was this gap in the market. Oh, wow. Nobody's telling the stories of winning entrepreneurs. When I was an entrepreneur, I would have loved to talk to people who have been there, done that, walked in these same shoes. But I was head down, butt in the air, you know, with my brother, and we're just working and trying to figure out on our own, which, you know, was fun and successful. But boy, I longed for having that, maybe that older brother or, you know, father figure that could kind of walk me through that. So maybe I can help people share these stories on a radio show and a podcast. That led to more investing. And, you know, this as I began making these investments, I remembered back to another Japanese word that was helpful when we built our group of security camera companies. I used another Japanese word called Keiretsu. And Keiretsu is a family of companies that finds synergy with one another. And many times there's joint ownership. And we had that at some level within our security camera companies. And I always thought the word Keiretsu was important. Every time I go to Japan to deal with Panasonic or Sanyo or these other companies, I got reminded about how these companies work together as a family of companies. And so we did that with our security camera companies as well. But what if we could do that for my portfolio of companies? What if we could do that for Sacramento companies? What if we could create a Keiretsu here in Sacramento? And that led me to talking about these business partners in my backyard that all love each other. And many of you know the story about when in 2019, when I threw that party in my backyard, we weren't up to 50 investments. We were about 50 investments at that point, but we had the party, and it was this vision that I had about, you know, these people that are all in one backyard that all love each other. And what ended up happening around that time is people kept coming up to me going, Mark, I want to be in the backyard. I want to be in the backyard. And so one of the people that came into the backyard was this guy named Rick Spencer. And he was in the backyard that day, but he's like, I want to be a part of what you're doing. And about 2 months later, COVID hit. And then that's when really we had this turning point with the company. Instead of it being my backyard, my teammates, Rick and Monique and I, we started thinking about what could we do in our collective backyard in Sacramento. Could we create a backyard advantage for the region versus just a small-time Keiretsu? And that's what led to the Growth Factory. And the Growth Factory is a venture fund with accompanying accelerator and entrepreneurial development center. But more than that, or as much as that, is the backyard advantage. And all these people that have come to help us to build startups and get these startups to the next level, this tribe is so powerful, and it's just beginning. It's at the beginning stages of doing something very, very special. I think, you know, we've invested into 34 companies. We've got a tribe of 100 plus investors, 100 plus mentors, civic partners like the City of Rose, the City of Rockland, El Dorado County, SMUD, the Kings, and so on. And they're coming together for this cause. So instead of having it be just my backyard, my little Keritzu, now it's Sacramento's Keritzu, if you will. And it's called the Growth Factory. And it all began with an ikigai, right? It all began with me being lost, being stopped for a minute, and using my imagination. So for all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship, trying to build something unique and special, sometimes it's a good idea just to pause, hit pause, pull out the dry erase board, and start writing ideas down on the board. Maybe you might think about writing a mission statement, and you can start it by doing an ikigai, right? What do you love? What are you good at? What does the world need? And what you can get paid for. And if you can figure out a way to bring all that together, now you've got something special. So to all you out there fighting the good fight, never above you, never below you, always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.